As our planet faces global climate change, melting polar ice caps, and ocean acidification, we like to remain positive. There's hope. We're still alive. Here at Take Back, we plan to get deep into understanding these issues, what we can do about these big problems while we laugh at the absurdity of being human too. Each Tuesday at noon here on Take Back, we will have thinkers, poets, writers, educators, musicians, and environmentalists help us get it right and navigate this crazy journey called life. We won't be afraid to ask hard questions, and we'll have fun and laugh too. So my first big question today is this. If we are dealing with such big global environmental problems, a direct result of our behaviors, isn't it a good time to ask what we are being taught and what we are teaching? Maybe we don't have it right. Today on Take Back, I have a very special guest who likes to get down and dirty, and he'll share his experience and vision about educational models and maybe inspire us with what he's doing with his time. He's a sculptor and an advocate for youth and nature. I'd like to welcome Zach Pine to Take Back. Welcome, Zach.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks so much for joining us. I've been watching you over maybe the last 2 years, seeing various events that you've been lining up with children in the Presidio of San Francisco and Stinson Beach. What are you doing out there with the kids?
Well, I'm doing a lot of very different things. I describe myself as a socially engaged environmental artist. That's a mouthful, but the environmental part I sometimes describe as environmentalist artist. The work that I'm doing is in service to the earth, so I always keep that at the forefront. The socially engaged part means that the medium for my art is not things, but is actually people. So I bring people into nature. I do events where we use natural materials to create art together. And part of the art making of the event is not just the things that are made, but the relationships that are formed and the learning that comes from being creative collectively. I do that with children and also with adults, and I use a lot of the skills from my previous work as a physician and a researcher in the work I do now.
You were a physician.
I was, yes.
And now you're out with the children in nature.
That's right, yeah.
What kind of things do you see when you're in these places and working with your art, with the parents and with the children? Give me a picture of what you do. And
well, I guess I could try to paint a picture of what a recent event looked like, and then touch on some of the things that I see in the events. So recently I had an event on Stinson Beach. It's an Earth Day event that I've done the last 13 years. And I invite people of all ages and from throughout the Bay Area to gather at the south end of Stinson Beach to clean the beach. And we partner with the National Park Service to do that. In addition to cleaning the beach, we create ephemeral art with sand, seaweed, rocks, things we find on the beach, and with each other. And that means dancing together, making music together, playing together, and laughing together. I know laughing is something you like to do. So a good example of that in this most recent event was I taught people how to make something called sand globes. I'll tell you more about those later, maybe. But imagine a ball of sand, and they can be quite large, but in this particular image I have, they're about the size of a softball. And we had about 10 of us in a circle, and we all had these globes made of sand, and there were people of all ages there and people who hadn't met each other before. And we were tossing them in the air in our hands. Imagine that you were tossing a pizza to make it flat, but instead you're tossing a globe to make it round. We're tossing them all together, and then I said, okay, now we're going to start passing them to the right. Ready? One, two, three, pass. One, two, three, pass. And you can imagine the chaos that ensued and the laughter that followed. And eventually we got down to the one last intact globe that hadn't yet been dropped, and a lot of cheering about keeping it intact and then challenging ourselves. So some kids said, okay, let's see how high we can go and keep it intact. And it went higher and higher until eventually it, you know, fell. And then we went and made some more sand globes together.
You're building memories with these children.
I am. And the sand globes are a great example because the memories aren't just of connections and ways to work collaboratively, but they're also tactile memories. They're sensory memories of the feeling of literally the earth in your hands, having the sand globe in your hands. You can't help but feel like you're holding something precious because you've made it with other people and it's something that brings you a lot of joy. And at the same time, you see that it's ephemeral, that if you don't take care of it, it cracks. At the same time, you have this great rhythmical, musical moment of passing, 1, 2, 3, pass, 1, 2, 3, pass. So it's kind of like a dance you're doing as well.
It falls in line with what's called place-based education, where the premise is if you fall in love with a place and joy and play come from that, a big part of it does, you want to take care of it.
Exactly. That's a dictum I've used many times. People take care of what they love. And so a lot of people describe me as an environmental educator. And then they have to add a tagline, something like an environmental educator who works at the foundations. So I'm not teaching people at this event in Stinson Beach about the geology of that sand, or about the microorganisms that might be living in it, or the ecology of the entire beach. But what I am focused on specifically is the foundational aspect of that. That is, why would you want to know about the beach? Why would you want to take care of the beach? Why is the beach important to you? And that's an emotional thing. It's an emotional bond that I'm looking to forge, and that is at the basis of a lot of what I'm doing, not just with children but with adults also.
It's a relationship.
That's
pretty profound. Well, it's interesting. I mean, we have such major issues going on with our oceans today, and we are teaching our children, with STEM education, a lot of facts and figures, but you're really going for the feeling aspect of that relationship build rather than the information, which is pretty powerful.
Yes. I mean, I was trained as a scientist, and I am fact-based in many ways, but a lot of people like to add the A, art, into STEM to make it STEAM. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that it's recognized that creativity, which is the basis of all art making, is such an important ingredient in all those other letters in the acronym, that without creativity, you're basically just opening up people's brains, dumping in facts, and then having them regurgitate them. That doesn't move us forward in any way. So I want to use creativity and play as a way of forging emotional experiences. Just like when you look at a great work of art and it inspires you. This day at the beach where people were having so much fun together and also moving experiences, having something beautiful that they made blow away in the wind or get washed away by the tide. Those are things that stick with people.
And the adults are getting involved in this as well.
Oh, yeah. And children of different ages. In our society, children are segregated a lot by age. Within a family, sometimes there's a spectrum of ages, but in our schools, with some exceptions, children get segregated a lot by age. Summer camps, which, it's summer camp season coming up. So everyone's looking for, what's the right camp for my age kid? And there are exceptions to that rule also. But I think that when I do events or other interventions that are across the age span, it enriches everyone. And it creates the kind of coherence that we need to solve the big problems you talked about at the outset.
And last week, I had a guest on named Deborah Lambrecht of Coleridge School. She had been in the public school realm for many, many years, 20 years, and she saw a great need that wasn't being met. And she ended up creating her own private school in order to, fuel that vision. And the one thing that she said was nature. Children and nature need to go together, and they learn by senses. Mm-hmm. They're on fire, right?
Yeah.
So you're really able to capture that with what you're doing.
I have the easiest job in the world, actually, because first of all, I love what I'm doing, so that makes it super easy. But also the ingredients that I'm working with are innate human needs. So everyone needs each other. So I work with groups and I work with connection. Everybody needs nature, and we have natural ecophilia or desire to connect with natural things, and that comes from our primordial roots. So if I have an event and there's a child, or sometimes a grown-up, who's not engaged, all I need to do is reach down and find something beautiful from nature and carry it to them and just hand it to them. Even if they don't speak my language, I can hand it to them. And I do that quite a bit. Some of my events are public events, and there are people who speak many languages that I don't speak. But it's a very universal language, the connection with nature, and it's a primitive language that children especially are attuned to. So there's nature, there's connection with each other, and then the last piece is creativity. So I think that we as a species are builders. Although our building now has brought us to a point where there's the risk of destruction from all that we've built, so to speak, I think that desire to build and to make and to create is also very innate. And I use those three ingredients together. So that makes it so easy. I can't hold people back from engaging sometimes.
I have to share, I ran a nature program when I was homeschooling my two kids a number of years ago. And it ended up working into a 4-year gig, I'll call it, which was not work to me. It was just fuel for me to really reconnect as an adult after years of not really being connected, and really brought me back to my own childhood. But one of the things that I began to realize while I was teaching this program with 8 girls, they were all girls, in the woods every Monday for 4 hours. And I had to figure out what we were doing. But I began to realize how we are so connected to all these elements, like the oak gall, how you can make ink from the oak gall, and how the Declaration of Independence was written with oak gall ink. So, you know, that turned into a whole opportunity to learn about how we are connected, right?
Which is
what you're doing too, of just really reminding us of what is beautiful and joyful.
Well, your story reminds me about the oak galls, about the idea of materials and what nature gives us. So I describe what I do sometimes as making art with nature. And I use the word with not to mean using natural materials as much as in collaboration with. You know, I see nature and the natural world somewhat like a master that's teaching me. And what we see in nature, the way trees are put together, the way that minerals are formed, the way that erosion takes place on the beach, those are lessons that we can use in our own lives. And a lot of the so-called art making that I do with ephemeral objects at the beach, with people, or in a park or a lake, is actually focused on connecting you to the materials and the natural processes. And that raises the curiosity about, okay, what is an oak gall? You know, how did they make ink out of it? Or I mentioned before at the sand, the question of geology. We were making these sand globes, which are made of tiny grains of sand stuck together by water. And some of the kids were asking me, how does this work? Like, this is magic. And it kind of does feel magical when you see it. But they wanted to know, okay, why is water sticking the sand together? You know, would this work if I used oil? Or would it work if I didn't use sand, but I used dust or mud? And I've done my own scientific experiments on these globes to understand better how they work. So I have answers, and I have questions, more importantly, to ask the kids, like, well, how would you look and see how the sand grains are stuck together?
That's beautiful. And it's interesting, this is such an important conversation to have right now, because there's been, I don't like to make anything bad when I talk on this show, you know, because everything has its place, right? And it's not good to make bad things bad, because everything does and can have a purpose. But technology has given such rise in our culture, and especially in youth education, and even the junior dictionary. Words of nature, words like acorn, and there were some other examples, are being supplanted by technology words, because there's only so many words you can fit into a junior, you know, dictionary, right? Junior level dictionary. So we're at a place where we really have to decide what is important for these for the young kids, and for parents too, because when parents reconnect and have fun, kids see that. Kids see it when I'm having fun, and if I'm having fun, they're having fun.
Yeah. Well, what you brought out about naming things is something I'm interested in, because more traditional environmental education has often talked about identifying plants, for example. And it goes back to that thing about protecting what you love. Sometimes giving something a name is a way of creating a connection with it and a way of loving it. And being able to recognize the difference between an acorn and a pine cone, that doesn't seem like a difficult distinction. However, many of the children I've worked with don't know that difference. And I'll hand them a pine cone and they'll say, is that a really big acorn? So I say, no, that's actually a pine cone. And of course, my last name happens to be Pine, so then we laugh about it a little bit. And that's my real name, by the way, not like an artist name that I made up. So I think the naming is important. And it is a way, it's a further way of forging that connection.
It's funny that you say that thing about names, because I chide my kids sometimes because they'll come home and talk about all that they're learning in school, and then I'll look out the window and I'll say, well, do you know what that tree is outside your window? Mm-hmm. Right? And my kids kind of know that, actually, the answer to that. But mm-hmm. but in general, right, just being out of touch with what's around us. And I'm thinking right now about there's a educator here in Marin County named David Herlocker, who leads free walks with the Marin County Parks. And I believe this man, like you, you know, you're changing generations and ways that kids are growing up and thinking about their world. I mean, it's very profound. And he does the same thing, but and takes people on the trail and points out all the bugs along the way and the worms and the spiders. And it just opens up this whole other world that we have kind of forgotten because it's not front and center. And mm-hmm. Right? And that sounds like what you're doing is just opening up that whole broader experience.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking a lot about children and nature, and I feel like it's a good time to give a plug for a national organization that's focused on this. It's called the Children and Nature Network. And it was founded by Richard Louv, who wrote Last Child in the Woods, along with some other people, about a year after his book came out. So it was about 2006 that the Children and Nature Network was created. And they are a vast resource of ideas for connecting children with nature, and also, importantly, research about the effects of different kinds of nature experiences for children. For example, taking care of what you love. There's a lot of research about environmental thinking amongst adults and what are the sources of environmental thinking in adults. And connection with nature as a child is one of the predictors of environmental action as an adult. And those research findings, and they have a whole research library and a research newsletter that now comes out, those are important for people who are doing things like trying to make a Create with Nature zone at their school. That's something that I also do, is I create permanent zones that are designated for creating with nature in schools or parks or museums. And those people who are in a position of authority to make institutional changes, they need research. So the Children and Nature Network is a great source for that. But also they have the family nature clubs and that sort of thing. So I would definitely look into that for those who are interested in other ideas.
And we'll add all these links to the website, and I'm sure they're on your website as well.
Yes.
Great. Gosh, there's so much to talk about. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back in about 1 minute. And we've got a lot more to talk about in terms of what's going on nationally as well. And want to hear about some of your future projects and how to get involved. So we'll be back in just a minute. You're impossible to resist, but I wouldn't bet your heart on it. It's like I'm finally awake, and you're just a beautiful mistake. Who do you think you are? Who do you think I am? You only love. right, we're back here on Take Back. The universe loves to laugh. I'm Mama Gaia. I have to go by that name here at the station. We have fun with it. I'm here with Zach Pine, who's an incredible environmentalist, sculptor, former physician, really creates the joy and beauty of nature with children and reminding us why it's important to get down and dirty, I like to say, and get connected. And it's something that I think a lot of us are questioning what we can be doing better as in education, maybe as a society, and really try to think big picture. So again, Zach, thanks for joining our show here. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the national level of what's going on. And what's great about this timing right now is that a book was just released by the World Watch Institute called Earth Ed, a State of the World Symposium, State of the World. It was also combined with a symposium at the Appalachia State University. All of this is online and will be connected on my site as well. And why they met, why the World Watch Institute met, a little bit about the World Watch Institute, one of my favorite organizations. They came about back in 1974. A guy named Lester Brown founded the organization. 1970s, we had talked before, was the age, the decade of environmentalism. Earth Day was created. So many great things happened in the 1970s, and this organization is just another testament to that. But the World Watch Institute, they work to inform policymakers and the public about links between the world economy and environmental support systems. They're doing great work. What was great about this symposium, and I've watched a little bit, and actually Zach has watched more of it than I have, and we'll talk a little bit about just how his work is really tying into what's going on nationally and why it's so important. Lee Ball of the Appalachia State University had started off the symposium with this proverb. It's a Cherokee proverb. And I want to say it here because I think it really sets a tone of what they are trying to do there at the symposium, a kind of mindset they're trying to establish, which I think, Zach, and you can correct me on this, is something maybe you're in tune with as well. And the proverb goes like this, all life is sacred and all creation related. What we do affects the whole universe. So let's walk in balance with Mother Earth and her people. And that was said by Smiling Bear, who was a Cherokee Native American. So this new book is out, Earth Ed, A State of the World. They're really challenging how we're approaching, on a national level, education and really championing more nature education, which is great to hear. And Zach, what are your thoughts about that? You've listened to a bit of the symposium. How does this all tie together?
I did. I listened to some of the symposium, and also if you go to the World Watch Institute website, you can find the book Earth Ed link there, and the first chapter is available to download and read for free. So the first chapter introduces the book. Eric Asadurian is the editor who collected, I think, 26 authors for the book. And there are different chapters, and there's quite a broad range of topics that are covered. And, you know, in the introduction, he points out that when he talks about education, he's talking about a traditional elementary school education, but also informal education for children, and also higher education, traditionally in universities, and also other forms of education for adults or other forms of higher education. And I think that's important based, you know, as I mentioned before, because it's our connection across generations that's very important in making an impact. He talks about a bunch of core principles, and these are principles that are reflected a lot in the work that I do. And of course, I hadn't read this book in advance. I didn't shape my work around this book, but it's very interesting to see how they stack up. And I don't use the word educator so much in my self-description, but in fact, what I do is healing and also is education. So these are the core principles he talks about. One is earth dependence, which is learning how we depend on the earth. And you mentioned how modern society is very technological. A lot of the children that I meet don't know where the things that they're using in their daily life come from. I was in a classroom and I said, can you show me all the things that come from nature in your classroom? And the kids are looking around, and eventually someone found the wooden door and said, that came from a tree. And they couldn't find anything else in the classroom. And then I said, well, have you heard of metal coming from metal ore? Oh, yeah. You know, a few of the kids had heard of that. These are our third and fourth graders I was working with. So we worked our way through some of the other materials in the classroom. The plastic, where did that come from? And eventually we came to the conclusion that everything in their classroom came from nature. But that earth dependence is one of the core principles that's discussed in the book. The other is interdependence. And in education, the current trends that are pointed to are an emphasis on social and emotional learning, so-called emotional intelligence, and character. They call it moral education in the book as well. And these are things that I also spend quite a bit of time working on. The social and emotional intelligence part is really, it's a pet peeve of mine, or maybe a pet project of mine, because I've seen firsthand from family and friends how important it is for children to be able to connect with each other and understand the emotions of other people and the communications of other people. So sometimes in a classroom setting or with children, I do an exercise where we make art with natural materials together and we have a conversation. And I call it an art conversation. And I first ask the kids, depending on their age, well, how would you define a conversation? And some of the kids say, the young kids say, oh, it's where I tell people what I think, you know? And then kids will eventually say, oh, well, you take turns. Or you have to listen and you have to speak. And so we take those qualities and we then convert it into a creative experience that we make together with art. So we have a supply of materials next to us. The two of us sit close by each other and we have a blank slate. And we take turns taking something from the library, I call it, of materials. We place it on the ground and then the other person takes their turn and they add it on. And then the other person takes their turn and adds it on. And as you build together, you realize, we're making a something. Oftentimes, because we're humans and we have a certain visual affinity, there's things that are symmetrical that get made. So one person puts down something on the left and the other person says, oh, I see, he put down the left, I'm gonna put down the right. And that is a form of social and emotional learning, to learn to take turns, to listen. In that case, you're listening visually, that is, you're taking in the information before you respond. And then with the older kids, we take it to an advanced level. For example, interrupting. Like sometimes you need to interrupt. Like if the person is on the wrong track or you don't understand, you need to pause and say, wait a second. Or reflect back to the person, like, are you saying we should really put this rock on top of these four other rocks? Isn't the whole thing gonna fall down if we do that? So that's another core principle from the book.
And really what that ties into is learning how to cooperate.
Yes.
Not to compete, but how to create something together, which is mm-hmm. a powerful skill.
Yes. Yeah, someone recently was talking to me about hosting an event, and they said, maybe we could do something like some kind of sculpture building contest. And I was like, oh, well, you haven't learned that much about me yet, obviously, so let's talk a little bit more. Because I don't do contests, no. I do collaborative events, and they're improvisational events. They're creativity-based events. They're events where everyone feels strength, and you see the strengths of other people. They're not events where you compete to make the best something. Yeah.
You know what? That's music to my ears, and it's funny that you say that, too, because it's something that I've always been bothered by, right? Mm-hmm. Everything has its place again, but I used to be really involved in the sailing world, and we, with the children, an organization, sailing organization, we would take the children out and we would play. It was never about racing. Maybe sometimes you would end up, you know, playfully, but it wasn't the thing. It was more about just being out there on the water and playing. And I would go to these sailing conferences where people would shun that. You know, I was the low man on the totem pole because we didn't race. We just played out there. Mm-hmm. And a parent even said to me, she said, well, competition is the way, though. Mm-hmm. You know, as if we don't teach it, we're actually not helping our children succeed in life. Mm-hmm. And to me, I thought, well, we're creating that competition, aren't we? Can't we just all play?
Yeah. That's very interesting. Well, okay, so I've done a bit of sailing. I remember my days learning to sail, and the most fun thing was the sailboat water fight. So you've got a dinghy, basically, that you're sailing solo, and you're sailing around, and you're scooping up water and throwing it at the other sailors, and you're maneuvering and doing all the things you would do in a race, but you're having a really fun time doing it. But we also sometimes had races. And sure, races and competition, they can be fun, and they're a way of honing your skills and learning a certain form, which is also an important thing. Learning to play by the rules sometimes is an important thing. But learning how to break the rules and throw the water over your left shoulder instead of your right shoulder to get the person is also really important. And that brings us to actually the third core principle in this book, Earth Ed, which is creativity. So there it is, right in the pyramid. And thinking outside the box is so important. And actually, in the introductory chapter and looking through the other chapters in the book, I didn't see a chapter on a very important topic that's important to me particularly, which is creativity something that you teach or can teach? Is it something that you can practice or get better at? Is it something that we all just have and some people are creative and some people aren't and you just have to leave it that way? I model a lot of my art life on the idea of social sculpture, a term that was coined by Joseph Beuys in the 70s. He was an artist who created one of the first so-called expanded definitions of art. And he said that people who do things that are creative in the world are artists. So if you're a radio producer, your art form might be your radio show. If you're a CEO of a company, your company might be your artwork. If you're a politician, your artwork might be the whole country. And you apply your creativity to making something from the media that you have at your disposal. He also said everyone is an artist. And that's something that I believe. When I do an event, I don't use the word art very much. With kids of a certain age, I say make stuff with nature. And when I say of a certain age, the young kids aren't afraid of the word art. But pretty soon, they reach a point where they say, these three kids in our class are the artists, and the rest of us, we're not the artists. You know, we're not good at art. So I leave the word art out, but I do foster creativity. I think it's really important. I do think it's a skill that you can hone and practice. And I myself do it 7 days a week. I'm always practicing to be more creative.
And aren't we all, we're all artists in some way. I have to share an anecdote, which makes me look really bad. But, you know, if you can
do
this.
Those are the best ones, yeah.
They're the best ones because I learned from it. I was working with a Waldorf teacher, Rob Harrington, who has been running a beach program for years. It was down in Santa Barbara. Now it's here in the Bay Area where he takes kids out onto the beach for water play, kayaking, all that sort of thing. And he had some art material out, and I was doing macrame with this little girl. She was about 6 years old. Quincy was her name. She was the sweetest little girl, and I was doing this macrame project from my big toe. You have to loop, you know, the thread around your toe, and then we were sitting there on the sand, and I'm trying to remember how to braid it, and I was trying to teach her how to do this, right? And she was sitting there very patiently watching me as I was teaching her how to do the macrame bracelet. And then she tried to stop me, and I had all these other kids to do this with, too, so I was kind of going quickly, right? Uh-huh. She was in the lineup. And she tried to stop me, and I then tried to stop her because I said, let's get through this, and then you can ask the questions, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to do that, but I also had all these other kids to deal with, right? What do you do? And then she became really quiet, and then Rob Harrington, who's an incredible teacher, came over to me. And he looked at Quincy and he said, Quincy, what was it that you were trying to say? This little six-year-old had a grand plan of what to do with this macrame bracelet, far beyond anything that I could ever dream up, right? And by my telling her to stop, I shut her down. Mm-hmm. I stopped her from using her own creative voice. Mm-hmm. You know, and Rob didn't even have to tell me what I did. I recognized, mm-hmm. and I came to it myself, you know, and it wasn't like he had to tell me, and it was actually more powerful when I came to that understanding myself. And so I did stop, and Quincy added a little bead, and then, you know, a shell, and this thread, and it turned into this beautiful bracelet. And then at the end, you know what she did? She gave it to me.
Nice.
And I keep saying that I learned, that was the biggest lesson I learned, and I learned it from my big toe.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But it goes like that. Maybe we by teaching... Maybe
a certain way.
A certain way. We forget that there could be another way that these kids see.
Yeah. So Neil deGrasse Tyson was on the radio just today, and he was talking about traditional education and how it can be so stifling of creativity. And yeah, that's a very good point. I have been surprised so many times by what children and adults do when they're with me. And of course, I also do a lot of trainings with professionals who already are creatively working with nature, and they want to up their game. And those people also have taught me a lot. So when I'm teaching, like a training is a form of teaching, right? When I'm teaching other teachers, I'm especially conscious of trying to be more of a catalyst for learning, and to always be open to those improvisational moments where one of the teachers that I'm teaching says, you know, I've been wondering about what if we tried doing it this other way? How would things turned out? And then there's a critical mass of us there, and we can say, great idea. Let's do an experiment right now. We'll try doing it your way. You know, that's not what I was planning to so-called teach today, but that's a great idea. Let's see how it works out. And that's I think, where real learning comes from. And where my background as a scientist also comes in is I feel like there's experiments to be done. And that the girl you were working with was kind of doing an experiment. She said, I've never done this before. I want to try doing it this way and see what happens. And it happened.
And instead, it was a big reflection of, I had this idea of what it should look like. Mm-hmm. Right? I was coming from this place of, this is what it should look like in order for it to look like a successful macrame bracelet from summer camp. Mm-hmm. As shallow as that sounds, and it really took me back because I realized that's not what it's about. In fact, that whole bracelet was more about not even finishing the project, in my view now. It was about Quincy being able to use her voice and know that her voice has meaning and it counts.
Right.
Right?
That's where the social sculpture part comes in. Mm-hmm. So it's not about the objects that come out of it. It's about how our society is shaped by what you're doing. So she eventually created something that gave her a sense of power and valuing her own creativity. And the additional component that I'm always trying to transmit is not just our personal creativity, but also our collective and collaborative creativity, how much of a boost you get from that. You know, I was going down the list of core principles from this book, Earth Ed, that just came out, and we've made it through a bunch, and then somehow everything we talk about is in the book. So the next core principle was deep learning, and they call that learning to learn. And that's being able to recognize a learning opportunity, you know, and what you do. So she was actually recognizing a learning opportunity by saying, like, oh, wait, she's got this thing around her toe and there's strings. You know, she'd already learned to learn to the extent that, well, if you have tools, let's try using them and see what we can do. The other thing that ties in is life skills. And you mentioned technology. I think that a lot of people feel that our reliance on technology and manufacturing has created a deficit in basic life skills for humans, like how to grow your own food, make your own shelter, make your own clothing. Those are pretty much basic needs. And interestingly, in this book, there's a section about that. But jewelry and adornments like bracelets are very fundamental in terms of human creativity. If you look at artifacts of civilizations, old civilizations, they use the skills that they use to make their homes. Those are the same skills they use to make their religious objects, their adornments, their clothing, etc. So that's something that I also engage in some of my events and some of my trainings, is how to do something practical, like make cordage from plant matter so that you can tie things together, so you can make a little shelter. You know, in America, we call them forts. I don't know if you're familiar with this whole idea of fort building, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big advocate of it.
Yeah. So in America, we call it forts. And some people do indoor forts. A friend of mine had a fort birthday party lately where they made a fort in their house with pillows and, you know, their sofa cushions. But I do outdoor forts, but I don't call them forts. I like to use the British term, which is dens. They don't make forts. They normally make dens. And sometimes I just call them houses. Or sometimes I call them dwellings or habitats. And then if I call it a habitat, someone says, yeah, we could make like a bug habitat, you know? And of course, fairy houses, those are tried and true. Yeah, many, many fairy houses have been made with and by me.
Those are I call those sacred. I did a lot of fairy houses with my girls out in the woods, and I sometimes go, and it's been a few years now, mm-hmm. I sometimes mm-hmm. still go back and you see little remnants of it, and there's just something so endearing. It's like a world that they are allowed to create mm-hmm. and make the rules for, and really isn't that mm-hmm. practice for bigger, for life?
Yes,
it is. And it all comes from play.
Yes.
Joyful play.
Exactly. And the idea of pretend play is something we haven't talked about very much, but it's something that's really important to me. And it's not just important for little kids. It's important for people of all ages. I mean, pretend play, if you think about it on an advanced level, that's kind of what science is. It's what if thinking. Like, imagine what would happen if this happened. What would be the consequences of that? And then there's socialization that happens with pretend play and the messages that get transmitted to children through pretend play. Something I'm really sensitive to is messages that don't fit with my way of looking at the world. And how do I honor what happens spontaneously with kids or adults that I'm with, and at the same time offer alternative ways of looking at the world? A perfect example of this recently is I have a permanent Create with Nature Zone in Kensington, just north of Berkeley. It's within a UC Berkeley property. And they have field trips that come up there. And I volunteer time when a field trip comes to have a group work with me in a Create with Nature Zone. And recently, and this has happened several times in different forms, two of the kids actually set up a shop. And the shop was a shop where they were selling things that they found in the zone to the other kids who were creating in the zone. And the price was other things that they had found in the zone. And particularly a certain kind of eucalyptus flower cap became the currency. So there was a little like economy taking place in the zone. And then there began to be a power dynamic, a hoarding of all the good stuff, who could get the most things, people rushing around, kind of a frenetic, it felt more like a city for a minute there than it did feel like the quiet garden we were in. And so, you know, I was interested to watch it unfolding, and I was also interested in there trying to see things in different ways. So I would introduce, some people might call it subversive ideas, I would call it alternative ways of looking at their transactions. So like using their money, instead of buying something with it, to use it to make something as art. Like take all of those things together, and instead of spending them on getting a rock, which what are you going to do with it anyway? We've got enough rocks. To use those eucalyptus flower caps and use them as fairy hats and make a fairy village out of them. Mm. So that's where pretend play to me is very interesting, because it creates a challenge for me about the importance of letting pretend play just flow where it goes, and also for mentors to offer new ways of playing pretend.
Right.
And that's mentor or catalyst is another way I would describe myself.
All of these conversations are so important right now, too, because I think a lot of people are challenging public education and what we're doing in public education. And I just want to throw a few stories out here. You know, I've got two kids, and this conversation is so interesting to me because I saw a lack of it in what public education has become. Some schools are doing it and maybe better ways than others, but it's an important conversation to have. And when my kids were in kindergarten at this one particular school, I won't name it or anything, but there were four boxes, beds for a garden, and there was nothing in them. This is kindergarten. Mm-hmm. But there was an asphalt play yard with plastic, you know, tubes and swings and things like that. but nothing in the dirt. And so I didn't feel that was right, and I got pretty involved, and I tried to find some other volunteers, which I had trouble finding, some other parents to get involved, and this is kindergarten. Anyway, long story short, by the end of the year, we had a really beautiful, sizable garden, just filled with all of these, you know, things that where you could make fairy houses, because I, you know, I was digging into my inner child for sure. And one of the things that I recognized was this: the kids who had the most trouble in the classrooms were the ones coming out to the garden and joining me after school. Mm-hmm. And they were very quiet, and it was like they tapped into a different side of themselves. And I saw that, and I thought, wow. And there was one boy in particular who would not sit still in the classroom, and he was considered a bully. I mean, there were a lot of issues this boy had, but do you know that he was the one who came out to the garden? And we didn't even talk. We just kind of did things in the garden and, you know, found worms and marveled at things. And I thought, is there something we're missing here? Mm-hmm. Something really important.
Yes. And in that instance, I don't know whether this occurred for you, but I've been in that scenario many, many times in school gardens where I use garden waste as art supplies, but also in some of my events and spaces where a child like that comes out and shows not only their interest, but their skill. And then the other children recognize something in that kid that they haven't seen. So a lot of times the kid who's a problem, so to speak, in the classroom is ostracized by the other kids. But then when they're in a Create with Nature zone, and it turns out that kid is like the best rock balancer ever, they want him to be part of their rock village because he's the rock builder. I don't know whether that occurred with that kid, but that's something that I've seen. So that the idea of recognizing our complementary skills and interests is part of that social and emotional learning component that's part of the trainings that I do and the events that I lead. It's really important.
And you've got some events that are coming up, and can you share those with us?
Sure. I'll tell you about two upcoming events. The first one is this coming Saturday. It's going to be at Chrissy Field in San Francisco. And it's at near the Warming Hut Cafe, which is right underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. So it's the farthest end of Chrissy Field, more or less. And this is now, I think, the sixth or seventh time we've done this kind of event. I do it with an expert rock balancer named Bill Dan. He's very well known, really, internationally. And the two of us take over a space there where there's rocks in a breakwater. And invite the public to join in and create balanced rock sculptures together. And Bill creates huge, I would call them not gravity defying, but gravity illustrating sculptures. Now, many people call them gravity defying, but you can't defy gravity. They look like they're defying gravity, but he makes beautiful sculptures that inspire people. And I set up a tripod with some teaching rocks. And as people come by and they want to do it, they say, how do we join in? And I say, you have two choices. You go play with the people who are there and just do whatever you want. Or if you want to learn some like underlying principles, you can stay here and I'll give you a 5-minute lesson where I'll show you the tricks of the trade. The biggest trick is the tiny pyramid, the tiny tripod. So all rocks have to be resting on a tiny tripod. So that event will take place from 11 to 1, Chrissy Field, this Saturday. It's obviously a free event. And after that, there's a top secret, only the listeners of your show and a few other people know, sand globe making down on Chrissy Field Beach right next to the event. So we'll make some sand globes together and create art with spheres of sand that you make by throwing them in the air.
That sounds like so... That sounds like so much fun. And if people wanted to find out more about you, what is your website?
They can go to Nature Sculpture. That's one word, naturesculpture.com, and they'll see that event. And then another event on May 20th in Albany, California, right near Berkeley. It's a sand globe event. It's a beach cleaning event. And it's part of a worldwide collection of events called Hands Across the Sand. Which is an activist effort to call attention to the risks to our coastline, particularly offshore drilling.
That's a big one. Yeah. Wow. And how can people get involved? If they can't come to these amazing events that you're leading, how What kind of inspiration can you give to people to create their own events? We're all empowered. We're all artists, right?
Right. So if you're listening to the show and you're an adult, then at some point you were a child, and hopefully you can think back to your own nature experiences. That's the best place to start as an individual. So if you're a person who works with or plays with other people of all ages, and you have a natural experience from your own childhood or your own background that you love, to do that with another person is the first step. One of the grandmothers who came to one of my events left and then came back to a different event and said, this is what I did. When my granddaughter comes over, we take a walk in the neighborhood. We collect things that are loose on the ground from nature. So we're not picking flowers, but we're taking leaves, pebbles, seed pods. We bring them back, and I cleared off my coffee table, so now there's no books on there. It's got our nature library, and we create stuff together on the coffee table together. So they have a bonding experience, not only in their walking, but also in their creating together. So that's like individual things you can do.
So that's a cross-generational activity. That's a building, creating activity. That's getting engaged with nature activity. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty beautiful thing.
Yeah, and maybe the granddaughter said, what is that thing? And the grandma said, I have no idea. Let's go look online. You know, so it's right. Potentially a learning activity in that way as well. The other thing that people can do to get involved is to look at the Children in Nature Network, which is the national group. And also locally, we have a Bay Area Children in Nature Collaborative. So if you just Google up Children in Nature Collaborative, or CINC, you'll find a local group that's a grassroots effort, part of the Children in Nature Network that's nationwide and actually global. So these local initiatives, like the Children in Nature Collaborative, produce events, trainings, and also connect people from disparate realms, formal educators, informal educators, homeschoolers, et cetera, to do creative activities in nature, and connecting people with nature in other ways. There are other ways besides just what I do, of course, many other ways of getting out in nature and connecting with it.
And being respectful and really developing a relationship with what we have around us.
Yeah.
This has been so great, Zach. I have to say that you really made an incredible effort to get here in traffic. Uh-huh. And thanks so much for making that effort and having an incredible conversation and sharing with me and everyone else that's listening to this. Inspiring.
It's my pleasure.
I have to make a snow, not a snow globe, a sand globe.
Yes. So if you want to learn about sand globes, look up one more website, earthinyourhands.org. So I said holding a sand globe is like holding the earth in your hands. If you go to earthinyourhands.org, you'll see sand globes worldwide and an instructional video with no English in it. It's all silent. That I made so that I can spread sand globes worldwide.
Oh, I like that. And with summer coming up, I think this is going to be a sand globe summer.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Take Back. The Universe Loves to Laugh. You've been listening to 102.3 FM, radio.dominican.edu. I'm Mama Gaia. I'll be back next week with Jonna Marino. She is a children's book illustrator, and she's been doing some great, great new projects and releasing a new book as well. Mark your calendars, May 13th at 9 a.m. You can listen to Graduation Day right here on Penguin Radio. And thank you again, Zach, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Fantastic. And I think it's time to get outside and go look at the trees.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.